President Barnes and Representative Brown have joined us at the table. First thing on the agenda, we will be hearing HJR 8 relating to the Persian Gulf conflict and HJR 12 commending the Alaska soldiers in the Gulf War. Should have a folder with both of those on your table. Let me just say that I'm new at this. So bear with me. Okay, at this time we'll take up HJR 8, a resolution relating to the Persian Gulf conflict, sponsored by Representative Barnes, and HJR 12, a resolution commending Alaska citizens serving in the armed forces in the Persian Gulf and urging the President of the United States and the United States Congress to seek an end to the war, sponsored by Representative Brown. You will note that a committee substitute has been drafted for HJR 8. This committee substitute combines the language of HJR 8 and HJR 12 and has been approved, I believe, by both the sponsors, Representative Barnes and Brown. It's my intent this morning to adopt a committee substitute for HJR 8, to which the committee, as a working document, and to move it out of the committee. I'd like to invite Representative Barnes and Brown to join us at the table, which they have. And we also have several people to testify. Please, if you're going to testify, make sure your name is on the register. And Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. And thank you for very speedily taking up this resolution. This resolution is offered as a statement of support not only for the President of the United States and other leaders of the Allied forces, but more importantly, for the men and women of military forces serving in the Persian Gulf. It is important to the morale of our troops that they know their fellow Americans appreciate their bravery and dedication. According to a spokesperson from the Office of the Secretary of Defense, there are 245,000 personnel from the Allied forces plus 475,000 American military personnel serving in the Persian Gulf as of January 25th. Accurate figures are not readily available regarding the number of Alaskans currently on duty serving in the Gulf. It appears that to date, Alaska has been most fortunate in having most of her sons and daughters left at home. There are, however, 7 Alaska Naval Reservists who have been activated for service in the Persian Gulf. I've been told that there are Army Medical Corps reservists from Alaska who have also been activated, but I cannot substantiate that at this time. Additionally, Alaska is home to several thousand active duty military personnel and their families who have made and continue to make significant contributions to our state. These active duty personnel are all subject to duty in the Persian Gulf. It is important to indicate to those men and women serving in the Operation Desert Storm and all military personnel that Alaska supports their efforts. I believe that all Alaskans were praying for a peaceful resolution to the Middle East crisis. However, exhausting diplomatic efforts failed to resolve the issue. To debate whether we should have launched the attack when we did would serve no purpose at this time. The fact is, we are at war with Iraq. War is never easy, and many personal sacrifices will be made. Let us, members of the Alaska legislature, make Alaska a forerunner and publicly acknowledge and support the men and women of our military services who will be making those sacrifices. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Representative Brown and I, have concurred on the sponsor substitute for the resolution, and thank you for taking it up as a committee substitute.
The record should show that Representative Bruckman was here at 8:37 and Representative Choquette was here at 8:40. Does the committee have any questions of Representative Barnes? Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. I personally feel a lot of ambivalence about this war, and I appreciate the acknowledgement in incorporating the thoughts of my resolution into this. I think I, like many other people, are deeply concerned about individuals that are serving there and their safety, as well as what is occurring in the countries that are involved. And it's my hope that our leaders will find a way to end this as soon as possible. I think the most detrimental thing that could happen would be for the war to drag on for an extended time. I know many people do not want discussion of the direction to send personal messages, I think this would be a positive thing for Alaskans who are there to receive a personal message, and it's our understanding that there are two ways this could be done without cost. One, through Alascon as faxes, or through the woman in Cooper Landing who is participating in the National Computer Network and sending direct messages to the troops in the field. And we have, my staff has attempted to, through support groups in Anchorage, you know, and Fairbanks, gather names of people who are serving, names and addresses, which is what would be needed to accomplish the last, be it further resolved on page 2 at line 22. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Questions, Representative Brown? Possibly the first would be for a motion to adopt the committee substitute. Representative Miller?
Mr. Chairman, I so move that the committee adopt the proposed committee substitute and move the original bill.
Is there any objection? Okay, we are working then with committee substitute. Does the committee have anything to say before I allow witnesses to testify? No? If we could, we have a number of people down to testify. If you could please come to the table, state your name, your mailing address also, and if you could be as brief as possible so that we could allow time for everyone to speak, to read.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Honorable representatives of this committee, my name is Ron Reed. My address is 2721 David Street, and I have a statement I'd like to read, which had copies made of. I believe that they're available to the members of the committee, and I'll try to keep it as brief as I can.
Does all members have Mr. Reed's statement?
No, I don't have it.
Maybe if we do that, you could just give a synopsis of your statements, and the members would have it there, and then you wouldn't have to read the entire thing.
I cut out some pieces from it to try to do that.
Okay.
Despite President Bush's, I'm speaking in opposition to HJR 8 and in favor of HJR 12, I was not aware of the committee substitute, and therefore I can't speak to that, not having seen it. Despite President Bush's declaration that the Gulf War is a noble cause, Americans remain deeply divided over the propriety of this engagement. When the Senate gave Mr. Bush the power to attack Iraq without further consultation, they did so by the extremely narrow margin of 52 ayes to 47 nays, reflecting the division of their constituents. In early January, columnist Mike Royko reported in The Empire that his mail was running about 9-1 against launching a war, even after months of incessant pro-war propaganda from most of the major media outlets. Indeed, several members of Congress in the course of the debate on the resolution to authorize force stated that they were voting in favor primarily to convince Saddam Hussein that the war, that the U.S. was serious, and the hope their war would then turn out not to be necessary. Yet, only one day after the artificially concocted deadline of January 15, less than a week after the congressional debate, and a mere 5 months after the imposition of sanctions, Mr. Bush launched his midnight air raids. Why this rush to war? CIA Director William Webster testified to Congress in December that the sanctions had been up to that time approximately 97% effective. Sanctions do take time. During the 20th century, sanctions have been imposed on recalcitrant states by other states a total of over 100 times. The average length of time for the sanctions to have the desired effect in these cases was between 1 and 2 years. Are Iraqi civilians dying and our soldiers risking death because an impatient George Bush had it with Saddam Hussein? There are plentiful indications of the artificiality of the January 15th deadline. It was agreed to by the United Nations Security Council after a great deal of administration arm-twisting, threats, and bribery as a compromise to an earlier U.S. demand for a New Year's deadline. Nor did Iraq refuse all offers to negotiations. Beginning early in August, within 2 weeks of the invasion, Iraq floated the first of a series of peace dealers to the West. This first Iraqi proposal, presented August 23rd but unreported by the media, was an offer to withdraw from Kuwait and release all hostages in return for guaranteed access to the Gulf through cession of two small uninhabited islands and for full control of the Rumaila oil field, the original source of the dispute with Kuwait, which lies in any case 95% under Iraqi territory. Access to the Gulf has been an Iraqi ambition ever since. mandate in 1921 deliberately drew up the boundaries of the protectorate to exclude such access? The answer of the White House was to ridicule the offer when it was made public. The Iraqis may indeed have been playing games, although an administration official who specializes in Middle Eastern affairs felt it was serious and negotiable, but we'll never know as no response was forthcoming. Without drawing further and possibly unwarranted conclusions, one can at least say the failure of diplomacy was mutual. Why the unseemly rush to war? One answer is offered in an intriguing cover article in this week's Nation on the economic incentives for the war, not just the swallowing of the peace dividend or the diversion of attention from the savings and loan scandal or the testing of new weapons or even control of the Middle Eastern oil spigot, though all of these no doubt have a part to play, but the continued floating of the recession-racked, deficit-ridden U.S. economy through Saudi and Gulf petrodollars, the U.S. Army as mercenaries for hire. Are we indeed going to Mr. Bush's noble war for jobs, as Secretary of State Baker suggested last fall? Is propping up the banks and the exchange rate of the dollar and obtaining economic leverage over our post-Cold War rivals, Japan and the European Economic Community, worth the lives of our brothers, sisters, lovers, and friends? Before I go any further, I'd like to make two things clear. The first ought to go without saying, but given the propensity to equate dissent with treason and support of the enemy, as exemplified by a t-shirt for sale in the Nugget Mall that reads, "Reward protesters, send them to Kuwait," I'll state it for the record. I do not, and the peace movement does not, consider the soldiers to be the villains in this war. They are victims just as the Kuwaiti citizens and the Iraqi civilians and troops. The best support we can give them is to urge ceasefire and peace, to bring them home alive rather than in body bags or human remains pouches. The second point needs to be stressed is that I, too, deplore the invasion and annexation of Kuwait by Iraq. But I also deplore the invasion and annexation of the northern third of Cyprus by our ally Turkey, supported to the tune of $500 million a year by our country, the invasion and annexation of East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, and the invasion and occupation of southern Lebanon, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank by our close ally Israel, the single largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid, and the invasion and annexation of the Sahel, or Sahara Arab Democratic Republic, by the torture state of Morocco, as Amnesty International called it, which is now a vaunted ally against the new Hitler of the Middle East. The invasion and occupation of eastern Lebanon by Syria, now a reformed terrorist state thanks to its role as a co-belligerent against its ancient enemy on whom it has territorial designs of its own, according to the New York Times. And last but not least, our own invasion of Grenada, terror bombing of Tripoli, and takeover of Panama during the era of America standing tall. For that matter, I deplore the previous Iraqi invasion of other people's territory, which was directed against Iran in 1980, which the Reagan-Bush administration tacitly supported. The point I am making is that while Iraqi atrocities against Kuwaiti civilians cannot be excused, they are hardly of a fundamentally different character from those that we routinely condone and dismiss when carried out by our friends and allies, and indeed by dictators who are maintained in power solely by our tax monies, our training, and our troops. As the New Yorker put it last October 15th, if we try Hussein for crimes against humanity, by the same standards many of the regimes we supported in Central America in the 80s, not to mention those in our government who directed the policies of support, would also be in the dock. Iraq itself, pre-invasion, is not absent from this list. Aside from our pronounced tilt in Iraq's direction during the war with Iran, by 1990, the U.S. had become Iraq's largest trading partner. Congressman Henry Gonzalez of Texas has charged that $3 billion in letters of credit were extended to Iraq by one Atlanta-based bank alone, and that the deal included armaments as well as quite possibly chemical weapons. This money helped finance the invasion of Kuwait, as Gonzalez pointed out. In 1989, Iraq received $1 billion in loan assurances, second in this regard only to Mexico. This was the culmination of a long and mutually profitable relationship. Ever since 1982, Iraq has been one of the largest importers of U.S. rice and wheat, financing a good deal of it through federally guaranteed loans. By 1987, 40% of Iraq's food was imported from the U.S. Over the years, the federally guaranteed loans freed up monies for armaments for the war with Iran and the invasion of Kuwait. During the 80s, Iraq purchased $46.8 billion worth of arms, more by far than any other third world country. Even when Iraq diverted helicopters purchased from the U.S. to military purposes in blatant violation of explicit promises, the administration hardly blinked. In 1988, when Congress wanted to restrict trade with Iraq due to egregious human rights violations, the Reagan administration lobbied successfully to defeat the restrictions. When the Human Rights Office of the State Department compiled a critical report against Iraq last spring, the Bush administration pressured the office to tone down the report in the interest of increased U.S. influence and better relations. In fact, the Iraqi invasion itself followed closely after U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie indicated clearly at a meeting with Saddam that the U.S. had no intrinsic objection to whatever means Iraq used to settle its dispute with Kuwait. This reassurance came in response to Saddam's virtual announcement of his plan, saying that Kuwait was threatening Iraq's lifeblood and that no country had a right to threaten another with economic extinction. 2 days before the invasion, a State Department official testified before Congress that the U.S. was not committed to defend Kuwait in the event of an invasion. Although by that time, according to the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the CIA not only knew of the invasion plan, but even correctly guessed the date. The State Department then forbade the CIA to warn the Kuwaiti government or people and forced the cancellation of a Voice of America broadcast on the Iraqi threat. Meanwhile, on July 27th, General Norman Schwarzkopf successfully carried out a command exercise for 350 of his staff officers based on the premise of one Middle Eastern country invading another and threatening U.S. interests. We need to ask, did George Bush invite the invasion of Kuwait, whether in fulfillment of short-term political objectives, geopolitical stratagems, or the long-coveted permanent U.S. bases in the Middle East? Or, as one Middle East diplomat was quoted, if Saddam didn't exist, would Bush have had to invent him? There are many unanswered and provocative questions about the origins of the crisis and good reasons for doubting that our media are presenting us with anything like the full story. The Barnes resolution, with its blanket and advance approval for whatever the Bush administration may be planning, is not a real gesture of support for our troops, but only for our government, right or wrong. I believe that Representative Brown's resolution, a neutral statement that praises our people in uniform and at the same time urges President Bush and the Congress to seek peaceful resolution of the Gulf conflict, much better expresses the feelings of most Alaskans. Thank you, and my apologies for the length of the statement.
Thank you, sir. Committee, have any questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Glick. Sorry, Bill. I said your name wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Glude. I live here in Juneau, and I'm representing myself. I'm currently between jobs, and I'm not in my former capacity, which some of you know me in. I think on the subject of war, there's really no one who doesn't feel a certain ambivalence. I think even in those whose words are very strong in support of the war, there's a tremendous amount of fear, a tremendous amount of concern for the people who are involved in fighting. I've long worked myself in the areas of peace and reconciliation. I do think that there are some improvements in the committee substitute version that you're looking at. Notably, I appreciate the inclusion of the further resolved, which ends with the mention of whatever means are necessary to bring the conflict to an end as soon as possible and in a manner that will help secure a just and lasting peace in the region. I think that's something that is shared by many of us. I also wholeheartedly applaud the idea of sending messages to those who are fighting. I think that sending support to people who are in a very difficult, trying, dangerous situation is an excellent idea. However, I would like to see strengthening of the resolution. I think a note that I brought around yesterday, maybe in the packets, did it make it into those? I would like to see consideration of a couple more further resolves. I would like to see one which basically would direct the Congress, the President, and the United Nations to try to work toward securing, at the earliest possible time, ceasefire in the war and trying to work toward some sort of a comprehensive Mideast peace conference as a means to achieve that sort of a long-lasting peace. I think the United States has always prided itself on being a voice for peace and reason in the world, and we need to strengthen our emphasis on that. I also would like to see the language toned down a bit in a few instances. For that reason, I generally prefer the language in the original HJR 12. It's a little too easy when we're involved in wars to make very strong statements and make things seem a little too black and white. And when we look at the congressional votes on this issue, when we look at the debate in this country, people who've searched their souls would probably not feel the strong self health righteousness that we like to put out when we're a little unsure of ourselves. In particular, I would question the assertion that there have been numerous attempts to resolve the crisis diplomatically, and that Hussein has uniformly rebuffed diplomatic overtures. Those are things that a lot of people do feel differently about. There's legitimate debate on, and I think it might be more germane to the purpose of supporting the troops to perhaps omit those mentions which are more divisive and focus on the intent to support the people who are involved. With that, I think I've hit my main points. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. The records should show that Representative Grunberg was here at about 8:50. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Mr. Glute, I read your January 29 letter and saw that item number 3, the Comprehensive International Conference on Peace and Justice in the Middle East, or basically trying to get these people to talk, was contained there. But I did not see that you had drafted a further resolve on that point. Your two further resolves dealt simply with points 1 and 4, and I was wondering if there was a reason why you had not drafted a further resolve on that particular issue.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, I combined those two points into one further resolve.
I see.
That the legislature has proposed a resolution regarding the war policy of the Bush administration, and I have a copy of House Joint Resolution Number 8. I don't have the current wording. I'd like to comment on the character of this resolution and why I cannot support this resolution or any other which supports the Bush administration's war policy. I believe that none of the premises of this resolution can withstand scrutiny, and I would like to go through them with you. In the interest of time, I won't read from the resolution. I'll just hit it point by point. Point 1, the record of the United States government provides no moral foundation for opposition to military aggression as such. Some examples are illuminating. Prior to 1965, both the United States and the Soviet Union were primary suppliers of arms to the military establishment of Indonesia. After coup and counter-coup in 1965, these weapons were used to effect one of the most brutal and extensive slaughters in human history, when the Indonesian military killed between 500,000 and 1 million people in an anti-communist pogrom. Tens of thousands more were imprisoned without trial, and some remain so today. Amnesty International accused the Indonesian Air Force of the use of brutal and prolonged torture. The United States government did nothing to prevent this slaughter, and it was portrayed by General Maxwell Taylor as a positive outgrowth of American foreign policy in Southeast Asia. By December of 1975, the United States supplied some 90% of the military hardware in the hands of the Indonesian military. This time, it was put to use in the invasion of the former Portuguese colony of East Timor, only hours after the visit of Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger to Jakarta. East Timor was sealed off from the outside world and the Red Cross was barred entry. In the following years, an estimated 25% to 33% of the Timorese population was exterminated. The United States' response was merely to limit arms sales to previous commitments. When in July of 1976, the Indonesian government formally incorporated Timor into the Indonesian Federation, the United States resumed new contracts for arms shipments to Indonesia, even though evidence strongly suggested that human rights abuses continued on a massive scale in Timor. Now we're asked to believe that Iraq's naked aggression is the rationale for this war. Point 2, from 1979 to this day, the United States has poured hundreds of millions of dollars into the support of the government of El Salvador. In that period, the Salvadoran army, extensively reorganized, supplied, and trained by the United States, has been engaged in the kidnapping, murder, torture, and disappearance of tens of thousands of union leaders, teachers, clerics, including the Archbishop of San Salvador, Oscar Romero, as well as oppositionists of all political persuasions. The only democratic government in the history of Guatemala was overthrown by a CIA coup in the mid-50s. Since that time, Guatemala has been a literal hell of murder, torture, and disappearance with the support of our government. And now we're being asked to accept that the American government has moved to protect the human rights, few as they were, of residents of a feudal monarchy, and to accept that bombs and bullets will provide this protection. Point 3, in April of 1984, the International Court of Justice, operating under the United Nations Charter, brought a judgment against the United States for violations of international law in the mining of Nicaragua's harbors, as well as other crimes against Nicaraguan national
sovereignty. Excuse me, Mr. Woody, I hate to interrupt you. Could you just please try to keep your comments germane to the resolution that we presently have. I realize
it is germane in the sense that I'm attempting to describe the character of our government's actions and how our government has no. The current administration of this government, as well as the government itself, has no moral basis to proceed with. I believe that this resolution is a morally hollow resolution, and the examples that I'm giving here, I am trying to tie these. At the end of each one, I'm trying to tie them to each point in the resolution. And I think if you're familiar with the resolution, you'll recognize how they tie.
All right.
It'll only be a few more minutes. It's not much longer. The United States arrogantly dismissed this judgment.
Mr. Chairman, I will return just very briefly.
Thank you, President.
The United States dismissed this judgment, although a few years earlier our government had resorted to the international court when embassy personnel were taken hostage in Iran. In December 1989, the United Nations General Assembly announced the U.S. invasion of Panama as a flagrant violation of international law. Again, this was arrogantly dismissed, and American citizens still do not know what happened due to the press blackout. Now we're being asked to believe that the United States represents the interests of the United Nations. I'll move on to a conclusion here. Once again, the hysteria of war is in the air. Truth is buried under the propaganda of war, and men, women, and children face the impersonal and heartless weapons of both the United States and its enemies. There are no winners in modern warfare, and our government's policies of sowing dragon's teeth throughout the Third World have in part led us to where we now stand. The only way that peace, justice, and the international rule of law can be placed on the foreign policy agenda of this country is if the people of this country join together and compel our government not only to preach these values, but to practice them as well. Those of you who genuinely wish to support the well-being of the young people in the Persian Gulf area, as well as all those who stand between the guns of the belligerents, will support the peace movement both as individuals and as elected representatives. This is the only opportunity to extricate the United States from the hypocrisy and corruption of our government. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Woody. Anyone have any questions? President Brown has to go to another meeting also. I would like to announce that I have scheduled, I probably did not schedule enough time for this. I had scheduled the departments at 9 o'clock to give an overview to this committee. But I believe that I should not cut people off also, so if we could go, I believe we have three other people to testify. We could do that, make your points as effectively but also as rapidly as possible. I don't want to cut off the debate on us. Next we have Amy Page?
My name is Amy Page. I live at 592 Cedar Street in Juneau. I have a statement that I have copies of. I don't have enough for all members, but...
We will have that copy, ma'am.
I also would like to read a statement by Mr. John Dunker, who's not able to be here. It's also brief. I would like to speak briefly on two resolutions before the committee, HJR 8 and HJR 12, regarding the Persian Gulf War. I urge you to consult your consciences as you consider these resolutions, which will be made in the name of all Alaskans. I'm sure you are well aware that there are a great many Alaskans who have done everything they were able to urge our leaders to find non-military solutions and whose consciences prevent them from participating in war. HJR 8 assumes a consensus in support of the goals and purposes of this war which does not exist in Alaska. I should say that applies also to the committee substitute. There is no virtue in blindly following a presidential call to victory at all costs. This is not the time for fanning the flames of war by demonizing the forces we have chosen to do battle with and glorifying the job of our young men, military people, who are being ordered to undertake. The human and environmental consequences are too grave. HJR 8 is not the message we should be sending now. I believe the best way to show support for all the men and women whose lives are at stake in this combat is to call for their return to their homes. HJR 12 comes closer to expressing a position more people could support. I would like to see us urging our leaders to pull us back from this disastrous course and to start working right now to halt the killing and truly protect the lives of our troops and all those in the war zone by bringing our troops home. That is a course which will set in motion the peace process which we will have to arrive at sooner or later. There is no glory in war. We all become victims, those of us at home who acquiesce to leaders who want war, as well as the young people who are required to put their lives on the line.
Thank you. Could you leave a copy of that also there on the table so we can make that part of the record? We have it. Thank you.
Mr. Dunker's statement, which also I believe I gave copies to the staff. Dear Representative Kubina, there are obviously a lot of people who need to express themselves on the Gulf War. I have been doing at least my share. It is natural that the legislature should try to express the feelings of Alaskans about it. But with all due respect to the sponsor and co-sponsors of HJR 8, do we really need still more pious rationalizations, still more jingoism, still more demonization of Saddam Hussein, and still more cheerleading for our war leaders? I doubt if such stuff improves the morale of our military men and women. It certainly doesn't demonstrate that they are there on behalf of a peace-loving, thoughtful, democratic society. And its superficially supportive note does not really do anything for the welfare of our troops, let alone for the welfare of all the people of the region. It just leaves them there to be victimized by the war. By contrast, it struck me upon reading HDR 12 that this is the sort of message that would have heartened me greatly had I read it when I was in Vietnam back in 65 and 66. It shows that we care by engaging the reality of war and trying to stop it. That's the only real support for the troops. I would have gone further and recommended the earliest possible UN-sponsored ceasefire and comprehensive peace conference. But at least HDR 12 sends the right message of support. Thank you for this opportunity to comment on these two resolutions. That's John Dunker, and he's 592 Cedar Street. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bishop. Committee, have any questions? Thank you, ma'am. Robert Wolf.
Thank you. I'm Bob Wolf. I live here in Juneau at 1760 Evergreen, and I have a brief written statement which I believe you have copies, so I'm handing them out. But I'll read from it. I'm here to speak about House Joint Resolution 8 relating to the Persian Gulf conflict. I believe that there are serious problems with the resolution as it is currently written. The problems, I believe, are not with the whereas statements, which detail the heinous crimes of the Iraqi military against the Kuwaiti, Saudi, and Israeli people, the unprovoked aggression, the brutal killing of men, women, and children, the plundering of a neighbor's assets, the threatening and recalcitrant response of Saddam Hussein to the world war. These brutal events, I think, are correctly named in the resolution. The problem is with the conclusion that follows, that therefore the state legislature solemnly supports those involved in Desert Storm, quote, as they take actions considered necessary to respond to the ruthlessness of Saddam Hussein. I'd like to ask you here, what might those actions be? Any actions? Any actions, whether they are morally right or wrong? Any actions, as long as they are considered, quote, necessary to respond to ruthlessness? And considered necessary by whom? The president, allied force leaders, unnamed UN officials? I believe there are serious ethical problems with the way this resolution is currently written. Such unnamed and undefined support constitutes an ethical blank check endorsed by the Alaska legislature for any action, moral or otherwise, by our national leaders, by other national leaders, and or by men and women in military operation. Think about what the legislature is, what this means in reality that you're supporting. Once large-scale war starts, it predictably escalates. There are many actions that we all know are bound to occur during Desert Storm in response to Iraq's ruthlessness. The aerial bombing of men, women, including women, children, and non-combatants. The destruction of Iraqi and Kuwaiti cities, including homes, mosques, cultural sites, economic infrastructures. The severing of food and water lines leading to famine, starvation, disease, and death. The displacement of vast numbers of refugees. The permanent destructions of families. The inconsolable mourning of lost sons and daughters. The long-term impoverishment of ethnic groups, and so on. This is simply the nature of war. I submit to you that such conduct in response to Iraq's ruthlessness is contrary to the religious values of many Catholic and Protestant churches in our communities. This is why I cannot support this current resolution of HVL. As you know, there is a range of ethical value systems in our communities. One of these value systems is that of nationalism and patriotism. In times of war, it's right and good to stand behind, support, and follow our nation's leaders, and that military action is an honorable service. Currently, the resolution is written from this value system to support our leaders and military. And from the values of nationalism and patriotism, these are appropriate ethical statements. However, there are other value systems deeply held by many Alaska residents. The one I grew up with and teach to my children and to other children's in church school on Sunday mornings derives from my Protestant church upbringing. In this value system, as a matter of conscience, each person must decide for themselves whether it is right or wrong to participate in the destruction and destructive actions of the world. In making these personal decisions, the church tells us not to automatically follow the ways of the world and deal with God, but to follow the ways of spiritual truth. We are taught that it is never God's will to kill one's neighbor or to kill one's enemies. War is never part of God's plan. We are taught to love our enemy, to combat evil with good deeds, and to be willing to suffer persecution in obedience to God's will. Under this value system, the destruction of lives by the military during war is a thing of great sadness and anguish. And under this value system, we feel deep concern and pray for the physical and spiritual safety of our men and women caught in war. Under this value system, we feel repentance because killing our neighbor in war is a sin that separates us from the plan of God. I believe in our communities in Alaska, there are at least these two value systems, and undoubtedly there are more. Because of this, I believe resolutions from the Alaska legislature, which make ethical statements, must be very carefully rooted so as not to denigrate deeply held value systems of the good people in our communities who follow their conscience and faith. In particular, resolutions should contain factual statements and ethical statements that, at the very least, do not denigrate the values of God as the churches hold them. Either that or there should be no resolution at all. Finally, our final resolution statement expressing heartfelt concern for the safety of all men and women serving in the Allied forces. Let us add a concern for the safety of all men and women in the Middle East as this terrible Gulf War engulfs them. May we pledge ourselves to play an active, life-giving role in bringing about a peaceful solution in hopes of making necessary military responses unnecessary.
Questions from the committee? Thank you. We have one last person. Is it Judy Brakel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Judy Brakel, address 440 East 1st Street, Regina. For many Americans, the decision to go to war was a mistake, painful, and disheartening. Many do not see war as an acceptable means of settling disputes, ever. Others see war as sometimes acceptable, but not when there are alternatives, for instance, the alternative of an international embargo, and not when there is such an immense lack of proportion between the causes for which the war is fought and the negative consequences to people and to the environment, consequences which will greatly transcend who wins and who loses in this war. We cannot predict the future of this war, but in only 2 weeks, we have the horrendous bombing of Kuwait and Iraq, which must be causing terrible human suffering, and an oil spill 15 times the size of the Exxon Valdez spill, and this in a region that was already environmentally degraded before the war began. But we already knew that modern weapons were too powerful, that we must find other solutions to conflicts. In this case, another solution was begun. The most comprehensive economic embargo in history was marshaled against Iraq. Concerning that, here are excerpts from Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell's speech to Congress on January 10th. Quote, it is significant that even the administration cannot and does not say that the policy of sanctions has failed. Quote, there has been no clear rationale, no convincing explanation for shifting American policy from one of sanctions to one of war. The administration says that every attempt was made to avert war, but there is much information to the contrary. People have reason to oppose this war on moral grounds and on practical grounds. They also have reasons for skepticism. Mr. Reed and others have mentioned some of those reasons. We have seen a series of enemies recently, Khomeini, Gaddafi, the Sandinistas, Noriega, each for a short time personifying the threat to America and then disappearing from view. We were surprised last year to learn that our troops had attacked Panama without consulting Congress nor yet the United Nations, which in fact condemned our attack. In a familiar scenario, not unlike that in the Middle East, we were there to punish a dictator whom we ourselves had built up with arms and aid, but who had turned uncooperative. Now there is a rush to war, to support the war. Now there's a rush to support the war, but we ask that our legislators do not presume to line up all Alaskans in, quote, solemn support of the president on this matter. What do Alaskans think? There have not really been polls, but the Fairbanks News Miner in December reported that a spokesman for Senator Murkowski's Washington office said letters were pouring in. Nearly 95% of the letters from Alaskans received by the senator insisted that a peaceful solution be found in the Gulf. He said, quote, people are definitely supportive of Saudi Arabia, but they want a negotiated settlement and no U.S. attack. People are registering a strong objection to force, unquote. I can report something of what has happened in Juneau. People who have spoken or written here in opposition to the choice of war include our mayor, two of our legislative representatives, even the newspaper editor. This fall, a local movement organized to oppose the war. This movement includes people who have sons and husbands serving in the Gulf, religious leaders, Vietnam veterans, and lots of others. After the war started, we had to deal with the question of how we could support our troops as people whom we care deeply about and at the same time oppose the war. At a public gathering on January 21st across the street over there, many intensely thoughtful speakers addressed that question. We realized that we could never be sure our opposition to the war would not at some point give encouragement to the enemy, but that the well-being of our troops is best served by calling for a ceasefire, and especially before the ground war begins. A young wife read a letter from her husband stationed in the Gulf. He seems highly skeptical of the wisdom of our president in this matter. Someone read a speech given in 1812 by William Ellery Channing, an excerpt. The cry has been that war has been declared and all opposition should therefore be hushed. A sentiment more unworthy of a free nation can hardly be propagated. If this doctrine be admitted, rulers have only to declare war, and they are screened at once from scrutiny. In conclusion, I ask that if you do pass a resolution purporting to speak for the people of Alaska, it will say something that can be supported by people who have sincere and heartfelt beliefs on both sides of the issue of war. I think we can all agree in our concern for the troops and in our hopes for their safe and speedy return. Thank you, and I'll get a copy of this to
questions. Mr. Morrison, you're not down to testify, sir, but I do have a statement from the department saying that you supported HDR 8. Would that also include the committee substitute?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jeff Morrison, the legislative liaison for Military and Veterans Affairs. The statement of support was for the committee substitute, as presented to us by Representative Lawrence.
That's all that is signed up to testify. Representative Broomberg?
Yes, I had another question for Mr. Blue on that, the one point. I wonder if I could ask you a question. You're the only witness today who's suggested specific language here, and reviewing your letter, which the members should have, the one issue that has attracted my attention in there is point three, a comprehensive international conference on peace and justice in the Middle East. I would certainly not just limit it to that, but to the entire problems in the Middle East. And I frankly don't recall whether there has been, ever been, unraveled ball of twine, as it were. What what's been the history? Has there ever been such a conference or series of conferences?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruenberg, I'm for one to ask a question on Mideast history. It's certainly not my
field.
Well,
I don't limit my question.
To my knowledge, I don't recall anything of the sort. It certainly would seem to be an appropriate thing at this time.
But it would to me, too. Mr. Chairman, and maybe somebody else here who's more of an expert than either Mr. Blute or myself would be able to answer that. But it seems to me that if we're going to bring some lasting solution to the area, it makes a lot of sense to get the players together and to try to sort things out in a forum, not necessarily the United Nations, but a forum made up of the participants there. And it certainly seems to me to be something worth considering. Maybe somebody else in the audience here has more.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my only point and concern on adding something of that nature to this resolution is it was very carefully drafted so that it would not in any way go to the problems of Israel, to tie them with the Iraqi-Kuwaiti problem, or to give a blanket support of any policy. So that's why I would really hesitate to see us put something about a conference, because then I would feel that it might be looked upon as tying the Israeli-Kuwaiti Iraqi problem together.
Any other comments from the committee? Representative Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to commend Representative Brown's Representative Barnes for putting together this committee substitute. I do have a point of clarification I'd like to ask, as well as several amendments I wonder if the committee would consider. First, on page 199, I think I know what's trying to be said here, but I wonder if it might be more clearly worded. Countries throughout the world almost unanimously condemn. I think the point is that most countries throughout the world condemn Iraq, and I was just a little confused. Representative Barnes, perhaps you could clarify what the almost unanimously is referring to, the condemnation or the countries?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the countries themselves condemned Iraq on its aggression. I mean, not everyone, obviously, but most countries of the world did condemn them through not only the United Nations, but in other forms, for their aggression against Kuwait. And their, and my way of looking at it, their next step was Saudi Arabia. So, yes, I believe that the countries of the world, almost, that's not everybody. There are obviously a few that did not.
Okay, so when I was thinking to myself, most countries throughout the world have unanimously condemned, that would be more or less saying the same thing.
Yes.
Line 7 of page 1, the phrase reign of terror was actually a time in the French Revolution. That's where the phrase came from, that was marked by mass executions of political suspects. And today it is a phrase that we've come to know as a condition of violence that produces, you know, terror among people affected. But my point is, it is a phrase. A buzzword like on the warpath or something like that, and I wonder if the committee might consider a more direct language that something to the effect of unprovoked violence, which I think says exactly the same thing without getting into a buzzword approach.
Mr. Chair, my response to that is that the people that were in Kuwait and came out of Kuwait told stories to the world press and others of the acts of violence that were really reign of terror on the civilian people of Kuwait, the rape, the murder, the brutal beatings. I believe that is a reign of terror. And that is the reason why it's stated in that manner.
Mr. Chairman, I agree that kind of terror exists. My suggestion that it better be expressed through a appreciate the discussion that's taking place, and please forgive me in my first committee meeting, too, as a new member. And the points are well taken. I don't in any way mean to diminish the impact that the resolution is trying to have in that regard, so in that spirit, I will draw my amendment.
Amendment has been withdrawn. So further discussion on the committee substitute. Representative Moyer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I do have another amendment I'd like to propose on line 2, page 25. It's an addition to the phrase, which I very much like, that we are sending a message of some kind for
that's,
armed forces.
Page 2, line 25.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if you could consider adding after the word prayers and thoughts. Certainly, throughout the day, if we were asked ourselves how many times a day we think of the well-being of our soldiers, it probably exceeds the number of times we actually pray for them. I think it's a legitimate expression of what we actually do every day.
Is there an objection to that, ma'am? Hearing no objection, that amendment is included.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any other discussion on the resolution? Representative Baker.
Mr. Chairman, I intend to support the resolution. I would comment that certainly we heard testimony of public members that are not necessarily in favor of the committee substitute, but you know, I think overwhelmingly those of us that had the opportunity to hear the State of the State last evening saw the Congress of the United States, the Joint Congress, and the President being interrupted 56 times. I think there's an outpouring across this country of people that want to send thoughts to those that are protecting our democracy. And I think the message here is one that will be appreciated by those Alaskans that are risking their lives in the Persian Gulf. No one wants to be there, but I think that this is very appropriate, and I appreciate Representative Barnes and Representative Brown's bringing this forward for our consideration. And I hope that we can pass it out of committee unanimously.
Any further comments on the committee substitute? Representative Gruber.
Yes, just one point that my staff has brought out, and it's an interesting and a close question, but I thought I have mixed feelings about it, but I thought I'd raise it for the committee's consideration. It's on page 2, line 12, the term consider, more candidly, because they didn't find me here, suggested that the word consider be deleted, because it's not just what they consider to be necessary, but the actions, in fact, are necessary. And I think, Mark, am I accurately stating your argument? And that, speaking, it's an interesting question, and I tend to think that argument is correct, but I just commend it to your consideration whether you want to see the word considered remain in or deleted.
Would you like to make a motion, Mr. President?
I would, for the purpose of discussion.
Is there an objection to removing the word considered? Representative Bruckner.
I have an objection, I believe, because I'm not sure that all the American people we're behind are getting into the war. And leaving the word considered in, it makes sense to me, because I think there are folks that consider the war unnecessary. Our action, our involvement, the United States action, unnecessary. So this leaves it open in a matter of opinion of the President and Congress, and I think it's appropriate to stay in.
I've raised the issue, and I don't have an answer for it. It's a well applied.
Representative Shilkett.
Mr. Chairman, I call for a vote on the amendment. In favor.
All right. All those in favor of deleting the word considered on line 12, page 2, signify by raising your hand. I oppose. And the amendment does pass. The word considered is deleted.
I think you do if you do. I think it's, I guess, it's a parliamentary inquiry. Different committees run differently. But it's in my thought that when there is a vote that's other than unanimous, that the roll can take and it's ended with unanimous.
Okay, let the record show that there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 yeas
position on the committee substitute as amended. I'd only like to say that I was moved somewhat by people's comments, and I certainly also understand the feelings that our whole country is going through on whether to whether we should be there or whether we shouldn't be there, and especially the people. I think they come back afterwards. That's the problems that I have. I have seen people go off to war in Vietnam, and when they came back, it was like there was no thanks any longer. That people forgot, and I don't know if it's because it was a bad war, it was a war we lost, but in watching the president last night, I felt that I hope that all those things that they're saying will be remembered when they come back, and that we don't see situations like we saw in 60 Minutes with the VA hospitals, where people just don't seem to care once their duty is done. And that's where my heart is. And so I'm going to support this resolution. I commend also Representative Barnes and Representative Brown for coming to agreement on the two versions, and I would accept a motion to move the committee, the committee substitute out of the committee. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we move the committee substitute for House Joint Resolution State Affairs as amended out of committee with that individual recommendation.
Are there any objections? The committee substitute then for House Joint Resolution Number 8 is moved with individual recommendations. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for your due consideration.
The recommendation sheet is going around to please each member of the committee sign it. We have obviously run quite a bit over on our next agenda item. We were scheduled to hear Departments of Administration, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Department of Public Safety. We'll take what we have time to take. First, I'd like to hear from Commissioner Dick Burton from the Department of Public Safety.
We're ready?
Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning.
Welcome, and thank you for coming, and we apologize for keeping you waiting.
Well, it's all right. It's kind of like going to the doctor's office, only this is probably going to be more painful. I'm not going to spend but just a couple minutes here because, as you all know, I've only been on deck about 2 weeks, and we're playing catch-up. And those of you that haven't met, Deputy Commissioner Gail Oreske, and the Director of Administrative Services, and takes care of our budget, Ken Bischoff. They've both been with the department for quite some time. Gail was an attorney. She was with the Department of Law before coming to Public Safety. And she's the primary legislative contact for my department on things to do with particular bills. And Ken is the numbers cruncher, I guess we say. And he has a good background. He was 6 years in legislative budget and audit. He worked with OMB. Previously, he's been with the department 5 years, so I was lucky to walk in with a staff of people that, from what I've heard from other legislatures, are highly regarded as one of the best in the administration. The only thing I want to say is when we get down to things that they can't answer, if they say they can't, I'd advise them, don't feel that they're putting you off because I have a strict policy here of having done this. If you get, call me anytime. I'm the one spokesman for policy. Because we get involved with things that happen, we've already had it happen where somebody wants to know something, they'll call a sergeant up in Anchorage or a lieutenant in Fairbanks. And it's an uncomfortable position for those people to dictate policy. You can only have one person responsible. I take full responsibility and will for the department, for those of you who know me that I'm that way. Any policy decisions, I'm happy to meet with you anytime here or in my office. May not always like my answers. I'm not going to like your answers. But that's just what I want to tell you. Janice, I've met most of you at one time or another. I was on the campaign trail with a couple of them last fall, which why I got lucky I didn't do that. But anyway, with that, I know you're pressed for time. You're probably standing by for a call to the House, I understand. So I'll introduce Gail and let you talk to her and let her present what overview we have, and I'm here for any policy questions.
Does anyone like to say anything to the Commissioner about him?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a question of procedure from the committee. Is today going to be the only day of overview for this particular department? Because I hope not. With respect to all of these departments, we're dealing with a number of departments that are fairly complex, a number of people who have not gone through overviews before on this committee. We're dealing with an administration that the legislature largely doesn't totally know what the policies are going to be, both of the administration as a whole and of the commissioners individually, as they're reflected in their individual departments. And I would hope, Mr. Chairman, that with this, and I'm not, we just happen to be, as we say in baseball, the leadoff hitter, with respect to each of these departments, that we have enough time to learn and listen to not only what the department does as reflected in the statutes and regulations, but what the commissioner's policies and the departmental policies are going to be. This is going to be helpful not only in the sense of an orientation for the members of the committee. I have never been on this committee before.
I'm glad to see you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. But also to give us some time to know more about how these departments are going to be working, so that we have some time to think about these before we really get into the confirmation hearings. It's going to be very helpful for us. The more we know about you and your department and how things are going to work, the better job we'll be able to do.
And obviously our time is short today, and I think what we'll use today is just a short get acquainted so that you meet us, we meet you, and that we most assuredly will have more time to really understand where you're coming from and really for us to understand the departments and exactly what they do and their roles in the state.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as you know, I'm the only person in the history of the state to do this twice. I've been here before, and it's an advantage that for me, I've been around doing this since before statehood, so I can certainly tell you about the Department of Public Safety. I started riding around in an Alaska Highway Patrol car riding shotgun as a territorial policeman in Big Dollar when I was 19 years old. And today I'm 39, so I mean, you know, I've been with it for 20 years. But I do have that perspective that I think, and having been gone for a while, it's healthy too, like a lot of professions, and I advocate that sometimes for this job, or most any of them, to take a sabbatical. I've stayed involved in the same kind of business. I've been overseas. I've been a police consultant. I've done a number of things, staying in the same line of work. But I have the perspective of it, and I've seen what's happened to this department, and I have a paternalistic feeling for this department, as you can well imagine. We're the one agency of state government probably has the longest history. This year is the 50th anniversary of the State Trooper of Public Safety, which evolved from the Highway Patrol. And we're doing some things and developing our history and things, and we've been involved in that. And I really can give you a perspective of statehood. Department of Public Safety was the state police, fire marshal's office, Alaska disaster office. As we developed what was recognized as one of the best management records in state government, we've picked up fish and wildlife enforcement. We got the Division of Motor Vehicles when I was commissioner last time. They wanted to give me the division, which is now the Department of Corrections, and you know, we have the domestic violence and sexual assault. We have Violent Crimes Compensation Board, the State Crime Lab, the State Fire Marshal. We do all central records, fingerprinting. All these things keep going. The only thing I ask you to bear a perspective, which everybody does, when you look at the Department of Public Safety, it's not a blue uniform state trooper. Any one of those three main divisions that we have are vitally important. My hope is to give the best level. We protect people, we protect the fish and game resources. Anything else that comes into it, and every year somebody wants to give me something else to do, if it doesn't lend itself to our primary mission, I'm not going to be real receptive to it. I've got to wear a dozen hats down there, and it's pretty overwhelming from what it was. I asked these people, I've got my same desk, the same beeper I had when I left there, but where'd all the alligators come from? You know, we didn't used to grow them down there, but they're there now. So I'm willing to work on that, but the state Since I retired, the population's increased by about 160,000. There's another 335,000 vehicles in the state. The pressure on licensing, the restrictions we have from the federal government for more testing, commercial vehicle licensing. Can you imagine the pressure since I left and the new fishing industries out in the Kodiak and the Aleutian area, the number of new driver's licenses and all that thing? There were 8,000 employees at a state payroll during that same period of time, but there are less people in public safety today when I left in 1979. So, you know, it's a matter of working with the governor. He's aware of this and setting priorities. The jails are overcrowded. There are not enough prosecutors and these things. We can't be everything to everybody, but I'm going to stick to my primary role. I'm not going to cut some of any essential law enforcement function out of the department because the enabling legislation is pretty clear of what our mandates are. And it's very clear on some authority that I have to establish headquarters and divisions, more so than any other commissioner in any other department, which has been ignored for the last few years, not to get political about it, but it's been ignored. Those are things we have to work with, but I have to work through with what the governor wants. He's well aware of it. I'm here to support the governor's agenda. I realize we have to cut budgets where we have to. We'll take those cuts, and this department's always been there. When somebody else works from 8 to 4, 35 days a week, you build a police station, which we haven't built in 20-some years, by the way, but you throw the key away. We have 300% demand, more demand for our time than any other agency. 37.5-hour week, we work 168 hours. So those things to bear in mind. When all these people want us to do to all these things, and these little pieces of legislation come in, and I see some of them surfacing already that they want us to get involved in doing, there's going to be some stuff coming up that want us to chase and catch horses. Well, I'm not a horse wrangler, you know. That's those kind of things. You'll never hear me say, I have no position. And those of you who know me, I'm either going to be for or against it. And you'll know very clear. My office is open. You have my phone number. I'm available anytime. And I'd be happy to. We, our team, we have to work together. And that's my job. I didn't need this job, so I'm here to do a good job, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I look forward to a question and answer session type of thing with Commissioner Burton as soon as this can be arranged. I also I'd like to state this is my first committee meeting like Representative Moyer, and I don't know if this is a proper. I'd like to have something from Commissioner Burton, which list the goals and duties of the department and what types of activities he personally would like to get involved in. I think he touched briefly on a couple subjects just now, but if I had that information, I would be much more in tune to another meeting with the commissioner, and I too have a lot of experience with public safety.
Obviously, we're going to have to, in fact, I believe I just heard the bell for the House. We're going to have to schedule some other time, Commissioner, and that would be something that possibly staff could get with all the departments over here, so that we have a good idea. We got a lot of new people here on this committee, and I think we need to really understand where each of the departments are coming from and where hopefully they're going. I hope all of them can.
We want you to know that. We have no secrets, and we're certainly able to do that. If Joe Kent wants to drop by the office, individually we can start giving him a briefing on what's going on and things of that sort.
Rep. Tim Moore, you do the 10% real brief.
The Council on Domestic Violence, thank you, Mr. Chairman, if you're considering to keeping it under Department of Public Safety.
Well, it is. It's going to take a little budget cut along with everyone else at this point. But that is one of those things that me personally, and that we don't agree with in the House about that, but of course I'm the policeman and they're not, so we have a good balance there. Then in the scheme of things, you know, if I've got to take a whatever $1 million budget cut, I'm working with the governor's office, across the board cuts, you cripple the really good programs and the bad ones say, oh, we escaped another year, you know, type thing. So my approach has always been the dollar amount, if it equals this program, which is least important to me, in the primary mission of what I have to do, that's gone. And what I've got left to do, I'll do well. But just philosophically, that's my policy, which these people can't address. I don't want them to. I take the heat. So that's what I'd be happy to discuss with you.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner.
Well, I think what we'll try to do is reschedule our next week and try to get some plenty of time. We have 3 days to get all the departments in here and have some more discussion.
I've got to go to Anchorage for a few days, but you don't want to hear any more of this again anyway, so these people will be available.
And we'll get you back when the time is available, Commissioner.
Be happy to.
I would like that. I had a question, Commissioner, but I have a feeling the answer would be longer than the question, so if we could schedule time.
You want a yes or no answer, ask me a yes or no question.
I'd like more time, too.
I'd like more time.
We will, Commissioner. We'll find time that you're available. And I appreciate it. And all of you that did come, I'm awfully sorry that I scheduled something else. I thought it would go much quicker. So let me say this, that so we do have a meeting scheduled Friday. At this time, we've got another bill, House Bill 37, relating to the investment of the pension fund, something that also was felt that needed to get out fast. And then we'll schedule next week more into the overviews and finding out what we're doing. Two questions I've got right now, just to get us going. These packets, is this something that you guys would rather have delivered the day before to your office?
Yes.
Okay, good. That's the way we'll do it. Would you please make sure you bring them then when we come? And we start at 8:30, and we'll try to do it because we're only going to have an hour and 15 minutes right now.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for being late. I think that at least initially, even though, and I know that this is a committee of referral, we've got lots of bills here. Some committees, the committees of first referral, have the bills, and they do their work early on, and then the second, all the bills make it to the second committee. I would like to suggest that you consider meeting, particularly with these overviews of these departments, which is going to be very time-consuming to do it right, and a lot of questions, and a lot of philosophical questions we're going to get into, that we should consider meeting 5 days a week and starting at 8. Otherwise, you'll have not much more than an hour and 15 minutes, because they're starting on the floor promptly at 10. And if we can do that, we will have enough time to really do our job and figure out what's going on right now.
Okay, one thing is I have trans on Tuesday and Thursday at 8:30. That's a conflict. I know we've looked at having some afternoon times, and we have
great
conflicts with people on other committees, like judiciary. I would not certainly object, especially this week, that we start at 8 those 3 days. That gives us an hour and 40, an extra half hour.
Yeah.
Would people object to that?
I just have another procedural suggestion, Mr. Chairman. Could we, as a policy issue, because I actually represent, I agree with Representative Gruenberg, I think we're going to have a large amount of legislation to consider, that perhaps that we set us a policy guideline to those that want to testify 3 minutes, so that the people have the ability to know that the policy of this committee and that they can condense their testimony. I think that in light of the large amount of legislation that we're going to have a difficult time doing the people's business if we don't set some kind of standards and guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Representative Gruenberg.
That makes sense when we have a lot of witnesses. I think that the chair has to sort of play that by ear and see, but like today, we had a lot of witnesses, and that would make sense. Sometimes we only have a few witnesses, and the testimony is fairly detailed, so I think that the chair has to have the discretion to
It's real hard for me to cut off somebody like today. I mean, people feel strongly about something like that, and but I understand where you're coming from there, and I think at times we'll have to do that.
At least if we see there's a large amount of people showing up, that if we set the guidelines kind of in advance so that everybody's treated equally, you know. Otherwise, we'll be in trouble because we'll miss every session.
Representative Shulkin.
I think there's a lot of value also, Mr. Speaker, in written testimony. I know that I surely didn't need to sit and have it read to me.
Right.
I can read it. And yes, if we're having our packets the day before.
And especially if we get that testimony the day before, we include them in all the packets, and then I won't allow people to do that again. That's very
good. I would highly support Representative Baker's 3 minute timetable, especially as the session gets on.
Yep. Representative Brockman.
Thank you. And I'm about right now, but I'd like to talk about protocol, for instance. I had to go to another meeting and back and forth. And also, for the record, your clock is fast.
Yes,
I keep effort within 8 seconds.
We're adjourned. Motion to adjourn. So ordered until Friday at 8. Friday at 8, not 8:30.
Mr. Chairman, I'm excused from that day, so I will not be present.
And I
may not
have
to.
You're excused also? So 8 o'clock is not good, is that what you're saying?
I may not be here.
At all.
Can staff give us wake-up calls?
I do.
Maybe we better see if it is early.
I'm here at the meeting. I'm not immediately going to the meeting, so now I have to get 7:30.
Well, not much of a